Hello, Greg.
This is Dennis here, and today is the 28th of May 1993, and I want to take up with you this very vexed subject of sex, and in general, and in particular, the To Sex Goals Package. This will no doubt, this subject and the goals package and so on, will take up both sides of this tape. Let me say at the outset that the To Sex Goals Package is undoubtedly the most difficult goals package you will ever come across in therapy, that a human being would ever come across in therapy. The reason for this is twofold. One is that games play is compulsive in the To Sex Goals Package, because the human body has adopted gender specialisation. And the other is that that games play in the To Sex Goals Package, as far as the body is concerned, is very heavily influenced by the certain considerations to do with the genetic track of the human body, particularly the ape period, the mankind's immediate ancestor, the ape. The combination of those two factors makes this a very, very difficult subject to get apart. That's why I'm giving you this information on the subject of the To Sex Goals Package. Without this information on this tape, it's very doubtful if anyone would get the package apart without having to do the research that I've done in order to get the package apart. Do you follow what I mean? And to save you having to do this research, I'm giving you the data. With the data, you can get the package apart rather easily. But without the data, you'd have to simply sit down like I did and discover the data and find out why the package is not erasing. But with the data, it comes across rather easily. Okay. Now, the very first thing we need to know about this subject of sex and the way we're using it in this technology is that I'm using the word sex both as a noun and as a verb. In the English language itself, the word sex is only a noun. Sex is not a verb in the English language, but I have verbalized the noun and I'm using sex as a verb quite intentionally and quite purposefully for simplicity's sake. There is no verb in the English language which means exactly the same as the verb to sex. There's the verb to copulate, the verb to inseminate, etc. There's lots and lots of these verbs, but they all mean slightly different. The verb to sex is quite unique in its meaning. There is a verb in the Anglo-Saxon language. The old Anglo-Saxon language has a verb that means exactly the same as the verb to sex, and that is the verb to fuck. But that, of course, is a dead language. And, of course, the verb to fuck is a dirty word in the English language. So we shall verbalise the noun and use the verb form of the noun to sex, of the noun sex. And we shall verbalise it and call the verb to sex. Okay? Simply for convenience sake. We can do this. It's quite in order to do this in the English language. It's quite in order to verbalise nouns, as long as you let people know that you're doing it when you're doing it. Otherwise, it can be very confusing. Now, the other thing you need to know is that I'm using the word gender. Now, the word gender in English language is only supposed to be used in a grammatical sense. We talk about the gender of a noun, the gender of a word, and so forth. It's a grammatical word. Gender is, strictly speaking, in the pure English language, is a grammatical term. But more and more these days, the word gender is coming into use in the language. Strictly speaking, we would say that the child is of the male. We should say a child, say, is of the male sex. When we mean that he's a boy, he's a male, we would say he is of the male sex. But more and more these days, people are saying, and I think correctly, that he is of the male gender. The word gender is coming into use in place of the word sex, where the word sex is used as a noun. The word sex is not a very good noun. It's a far, far better verb than it is a noun. the word gender is the better noun, as far as a human being is concerned. When talking about the sexual nature of the person, whether the person be a male or a female, the word gender is a better word, I think, than to say that the person is of the male sex or of the female sex. I think that sounds rather stilted, but nevertheless, that is the correct use of English. But I'm not going to use it that way. I'm going to use the word gender, and I'm going to use the word gender in the sense that I've explained it. That I'm when I say that a person is of the male gender, I mean that he is a male. I don't mean that the word male is a masculine word in the English language. I'm not using the word gender in a grammatical sense. I'm using it in a definite life and livingness sense to do with real human beings in the real universe. Now, the first thing you need to know is that the whole subject of sexuality resides within the four legs of the to sex goals package. There's no aspect of sex which is outside of that goals package. Now, that might be a very difficult thing for you to grasp immediately, but I can assure you that it's the case. And as you work more and more with the sex goals package in therapy, you will come to understand the truth of it. And that when this the sex goals package is erased in therapy, then the whole subject of sex is erased from the human mind. Now, a person can do this. The spiritual being can do this, can erase the subject of sex from his psyche. But you must clearly understand that because your body is also active on the subject of sex, that in other words, that it's a sex goals package you share in common with your body, and you will not erase the subject of sex from your body. Your body is active on the subject of sex, just like it's active on the subject of eating and so on. It's, in other words, that the sex goals package is a bodily goals package, and you share it in common with your body. So when we talk about erasing the sex goals package, we mean the spiritual being can erase the goals package out of his psyche. But your body will still retain all of its sexuality. In fact, your sexuality of your body will be enhanced after you've erased the sex goals package. It won't influence the body at all. And you should make no attempt to erase the sexuality of your body. You could only make your body very sick by interfering with its sexuality, with its gender and its sexuality and its various sexual mechanisms. Simply leave it alone. It's a part of the mock-up. You won't change the mock-up. You simply make it very sick if you attempt to. But you can, and it's very beneficial to erase the subject of sex from the human psyche. Just in passing, I can tell you at this stage that no one in the whole of the human history, to the best of my knowledge, has ever erased the sex goals package out of this, the subject of sex out of their psyche, apart from people who have worked with this technology of mine. Now, I may be wrong in that. There may be various Indian mystics and various Chinese Eastern mystics that have done it, and it's gone unrecorded. So I won't be adamant on the subject, but I will say, as far as I know, and my researches are quite extensive on this subject, the best that people have ever done with other psychotherapies that I know of is to produce a reduction, a relief, and to gain some insight into the subject of sexuality. That's the best. But we can go a lot further than that. We can actually erase it from the psyche. And as I say, to the best of my knowledge, it's never been done before. So when you finally succeed in erasing the sex goals package in therapy, you can pat yourself on the back. You can give yourself a welcome pat on the back, because you've done something that no one else has ever done, except the people who are doing this therapy. We're the only ones that have ever done it, to the best of my knowledge. You also need to know at the very outset that the subject of sex would erase very, very easily from the human psyche if the body had not adopted compulsive games play on the subject of sex. Now, what do I mean by compulsive games play on the subject of sex as far as the body is concerned? We better clear this up right from the very outset. Now, what do we mean? Well, I mean that the body has adopted gender specialization. the body, human bodies are either male and not female, or they are female and not male. We don't find human bodies that are both male and female, nor do we find human bodies that are neither male nor female. Now, in line with our knowledge of compulsive games play in a goals package, we know that there's an identification between the postulates in the goals package. Well, in the to sex goals package, the to sex postulate is identical with the to not be sexed postulate. That is the identification that to sex equals to not be sexed, and to be sexed equals to not sex. They are the false identifications that bring about compulsive games play in the to sex goals package. Now there is another false identification that comes about here on the subject of human body and in the subject of sex that you should know about. Because the male operates, as far as the human body is concerned, and I will explain this in detail later, he operates exclusively on the to sex postulate, and the female operates exclusively under the to be sex postulate, then there is a false identification in the genders amongst humans at a bodily level, and the false identification is that a male equals a non-female and a female equals a non-male. So we have two false identifications. One, that to sex equals to not be sexed, and to be sexed equals to not sexed. They're the false identifications of the postulates. And that we have the false identification of the genders. We have a male equals a non-female, and a female equals a non-male. And both of those identifications are false. They're all false identifications. But they are extant, and you will find them. Your body subscribes to them and believes in them quite implicitly. And if it weren't for the fact that you're attached to a mock-up, you're attached to a body, you're attached to a genetic life form that is so devoted to compulsive gameplay on the subject of sex, then if it weren't for this, then the to sex goals package would erase rather easily in therapy. It is the body component that will bug you all the time. If you were a free spirit wandering around in the universe and you weren't attached to a body that had adopted compulsive games play, then the sex goals package would be a very easy one to erase. If it posed you any problem at all, even if you were interested in the subject, which you probably wouldn't be. But it certainly would pose you no problems in therapy. It's only because you're attached to a body that's adopted compulsive games play on the subject of sex that you will have any difficulty erasing this subject in therapy. Most of this tape, then, you'll find will be taken up on some of the peculiarities of the body sexuality, which you will need to know about in order to erase the to sex goals package in therapy. So that is why there's very strong stress on the body's peculiarities on the subject of sexuality, the human body's peculiarities, I should say. But before we discuss these peculiarities in detail, it's an excellent idea to make a short look at the subject of sexuality amongst life forms in the universe at large, to see how this subject ever got into existence and what it's all about. Well. Sex, of course, is the subject of reproduction, of how life forms reproduce themselves. And you should know that the simplest of life forms simply don't reproduce sexually at all. They reproduce asexually, and they reproduce by a system called cell splitting. They're usually single cell creatures, like bacterium or amoeba or viruses. And when they want to reproduce, the cell simply splits itself into two, and the two halves go their separate ways and become fully grown creatures in their own right. Cell splitting. It's asexual reproduction. Now, the problem with cell splitting, as far as a life form is concerned, is that it's that the reproduction is a clone. In other words, there's no new genetic information in the offspring than there was in the parent. The parents are identical genetically. The offspring are identical genetically to their parents, and there's never any new genetic material gets into the stream, gets into the life form. And this is a liability to a life form, because it means that the life form cannot easily change against a changing environment, cannot easily adapt to the environment. I mean, it's very difficult for organisms which reproduce asexually to change. They can, but it's difficult for them to do so. They overcome their difficulties by an enormously rapid reproduction rate. But you can learn all about this if you want to study it up. If you want to study bacteriology and virology, you can learn how these little tiny creatures overcome these difficulties. But generally speaking, that is the liability there. In order to overcome this difficulty, way back along the line, the creatures said, well, we'll have to do something about this, and they came up with a system, and this system they came up with was called sex. The system was called sex, and they reproduce sexually. Now, the way the creature reproduces sexually, it builds a specialized sex cell. One of its cells, it builds a special sex cell which contains all of its genetic information there, and it's set up in such a way. It's not an ordinary cell, it's a special cell, and it's designed to fuse with the sex cell of another creature of its own type, which may have a slightly different genetic pattern. And the two sex cells fuse and they become a separate organism. And the separate organism has 50% of its genetic information from one of its parents and 50% of its genetic information from the other one of its parents. And the offspring thereby benefits from having the genetic information of both of its parents, and this allows it to survive better in the universe. And it really does. It's a wonderful survival mechanism. It's sex in the universe. It gives the creatures that reproduce sexually a definite edge over those who reproduce asexually. Nevertheless, you will still find creatures, simple creatures that reproduce asexually. You can see them. You can buy even a cheap microscope and go down and get a bit of pond water and put a drop of it under the slide of a microscope. You can sit and watch the amoeba and the paramecia reproducing by cell splitting and so forth. They're doing it all the time, all day long, millions and millions of them or thousands and thousands of them in a drop of pond water. You can watch them. They're all there doing it. They're still doing it. They've been doing it for millions of years, and unless mankind blows the planet up, they'll still be doing it in millions of years' time. The system does work, asexual reproduction. But that doesn't concern us. We're concerned with the sexual reproduction. Now, the two cells, these two specialized sex cells, one is called a female cell and one is called a male cell. The difference between the two cells is quite interesting. The male cell is the mobile cell, the active one, and it seeks out the female cell. The male cell is usually very small. Its main characteristics is mobility, and it's simply nothing else but a mobile mass of genetic material. It has usually a very short life. It doesn't live very long, but it's mobile. The female sex cell is much larger. It's also called an ovum or an egg. It contains a lot of food material, so it can live for a long, long while, and it's not mobile. It stays put, and it relies upon the male cell to come to it, and the male cell fertilizes, as we say, the female cell. The female cell doesn't seek the male cell. The male cell always seeks out the female cell. So there's the difference between those two types of sex cells. This is common for all creatures that use sexuality. They always have both male cells. There's the male cell and the female cell, and the male cell is the active one, and the female cell is the large one that stays put. And it's the female cell which, when fertilized, becomes the new creature. The
you might say, the little tiny male cell disappears inside and is absorbed by the ovum. That would be another way to put it. But nevertheless, it contributes, still contributes half of the genetic material to the egg. And then the egg goes ahead and splits, cell splitting takes place, and the egg then grows into and becomes the new creature. And so on, as you can read about in the biology textbooks. Now, this subject of the sex cells is very important to the subject of sexuality, because as far as the body is concerned, as far as your body is concerned, the whole subject of sex is the game of the sex cells. That is its total, that is the totality of it as far as the body is concerned. The whole of the body's sexuality is devoted to getting its sex cells married up with the sex cells of someone of the opposite sex. That is the whole idea. So it's as far as the body is concerned, the sex is the game of the sex cells. It's the sex cells game. So bear that in mind, that the sex cells is the be all and end all of the body's sex game. They've got no other purpose as far as the body's concerned, except the subject of these sex cells. That is it. That sex, as far as your body is concerned, is the sex cells. Now, there's a number of systems. There's two well-known systems of operation that creatures use to get their sex cells together and so forth in the universe. And the first of these is what we call the bisexual creatures. Now, this was no doubt the first system. And a bisexual creature is also known as a hermaphrodite. Bisexual hermaphrodite mean the same thing, and it means that the creature, its body contains both male and female sex cells. It's a hermaphrodite, it's a bisexual. And the creature's its male sex cells cannot fertilize its own female sex cells. There's a device, usually there's a device to prevent this from happening, but nevertheless the creature's male sex cells can fertilize the female sex cells of another creature of its type, and also its own female sex cells can be fertilized by the male sex cells of another creature of the same type. A good example of the hermaphrodite, the bisexual, is the earthworm. All earthworms are bisexuals. And many trees are bisexuals. They have both male sex cells and female sex cells. And other trees are not bisexuals. But we'll go into that in a moment. I'll tell you what the other system is. They're not bisexuals. But some trees are, some trees aren't. Earthworms are, and so on. That's the bisexual system. Now, it's a very, very efficient system, the bisexual system is, and from a biological point of view, the only reason that's known of, that I know of, that's known of why a creature ever got off of bisexual system of reproduction, is because of compulsive games playing, the sex goals package, that leads to gender specialization. And that is the second type of system that the creatures use. They cease to be bisexual, and they become unisexual. They become either males or females, and not both. Now, some trees are like that. Some trees are masculine trees. Some trees they have feminine trees of the same type. And most so-called higher mammals are of that type. They're either male creatures or they're female creatures, and they're not both. And certainly the ape family falls into that category, and human beings fall into that category. The male's body only contains male sex cells, and the female body only contains female sex cells. And that's what we call gender specialization. When we say gender specialization, it's a phenomenon of the sex cells. It's not a phenomenon of anything else. It's simply a matter of that a male body is a body that only contains male sex cells, and a female body is a body that only contains female sex cells, and that's the gender specialization at a sex cell level, and that is the only level that really means anything. Let's quickly tie up this subject of the bisexuality and unisexuality with our classes here, our logical classes. A bisexual creature, because it can be both male and female, so it can hold that class, and it can, and in any particular sexual encounter it can be male and not female, and in another sexual encounter it can be female and not male. The only thing that it can't be is neither male nor female. So three of the possible four classes the bisexual can occupy. He can be both male and female, he can be male and not female, and he can be female and not male. I should say he or she. But so three of the four classes the bisexual can handle. But the uni class creature can only handle one of the classes. He can't be both male and female, but he could be either male and not female, or female and not male. And he can't be neither male nor female. So he can only be in one of the classes. So bear that in mind. When the creature stops being bisexual and takes up unisexuality, each individual creature drops two of the classes. The bisexual can occupy three out of the possible four classes. The unisexual creature can only occupy one. He's either a male and not a female, or he's a female and not a male. That's one out of the four classes he can occupy. So it's important to grasp that. It follows immediately from that that it's very hard to conceive of a bisexual creature having any sexual problems. If you think about that, it would be because he's both male and female. There can't be any great conflict in his mind between masculinity and femininity, can there? That's the basis of all conceivable problems on the subject of sex. You see, you're bisexual, doesn't have any sexual problems. If you could converse with an earthworm, the earthworm would have a great difficulty in understanding the idea of a sexual problem, because the earthworm simply doesn't have any sexual problems. He can't have, he's bisexual. See that? It's only creatures that are unisexual, that take up gender specialisation, that have sexual problems. And I can assure you that all of them do. Animals that have taken it up have sexual problems. Insects that have taken up gender specialisation have sexual problems. They don't talk about them because they can't talk. But if you examine them, you see that they do have problems. And mankind certainly has problems on the subject of sex. And they all stem from, because his body has taken up gender specialisation. If the human body was bisexual, mankind would have no sexual problems, I can assure you. I can assure you that. You bear it in mind at all times. Well then, this creature having taken up gender specialisation, in terms of the logical set and so, but what would the logical set look like that the male and the female is occupying? What would the set look like? There's considerable reductions. I won't give you all the reductions and so forth that come through from asexual beings right away through hermaphroditism and the bisexuals down through to gender specialisation. It would just take me too long to write them all down. I've got them written down. I know them. But we're only interested in what the human being situation is, what the reduction is for the human being. Well, this is what it would look like, what it looks like for a human being. The human being is either a male or a female. Let's take the male. Now, what does he operate on? We're talking about the male body now. We're not talking about the male spiritual being. We're talking about the male body. Well, the male body operates on to sex postulate and to not be sex postulate. And he also operates on, he also contains male sex cells and no female sex cells. Now the female operates on the to be sex postulate and the to not sex postulate, and the creature contains female sex cells and no male sex cells, and that's the two sets, that's the two classes. Those two classes constitute the universe of human sexuality at the bodily level. And they're the only postulates that are used, and there's the sex cell configuration. So that's what it looks like if you were to write it down on a bit of paper. That's what it looks like. But you might say to yourself, well, hold your horses, Dennis. If a body I used to sound to say, Dennis, that the human body, a human male body, cannot go into the to not sex mode. That's true, it can't. It's fixed into sex. And well, how does it move then down, up and down the scale? Does it ever move beyond the zero point? No, it never does. It's the human body, a male body, is fixed in the to sex mode, plus to sex. It never goes over the zero point and goes into to not sex. It's in always in the, it just simply moves up and down, goes high intensity to sex, low intensity to sex, but it never crosses the zero point. Similarly with the it's to not be sex postulate, it goes high intensity to not be sexed, low intensity to not be sex, but it's always on the negative side. It never goes over the positive line, never goes in, over the positive into to be sexed, because that would be the feminine postulate, you see. You follow that? It's a little bit tricky until you get the hang of it. Similarly with the female body is only in to be sexed and positive, stays on the positive side, never gets into to not be sexed. It's only in to be sexed and to not sex, stays on the negative side of to not sex, never gets into the to sex. And that's the way it looks. And just as the male moves up and down high to lower intensity of his must sex, I'll use must sex instead of just sex from this point onwards, I'll use the enforcement of the postulate. Goes from high intensity, the male goes high intensity must sex down to low intensity must sex. Similarly, the female goes from high intensity must be sex down to low intensity must be sex. And as far as the body is concerned, it responds to these relative movements just as if the postulate was moving over the zero point. In other words, the relative intensity of the postulate is sufficient to permit the games play to occur. Do you follow that? I could write this down much easier on a piece of paper, but it's not easy to explain it verbally. But I think I can get it through. Do you understand it? It's simply a matter of relative. You just get the creature is stuck on the positive side or stuck on the negative side of its postulate, and it moves up and down the positive or the negative side of its postulate, and it can still play games by moving up and down. It's a restricted games play. But although this is true for the body, when you're erasing the to sex goals package in therapy, you always use the positive and negative postulates. You use must sex, mustn't sex, positive, negative, must be sexed, mustn't be sexed, positive, negative. You use the whole range. The spirit, the human spirit, can use the whole range. The body, because of its gender specialization, has got itself stuck. Well, okay, that's the body's problem. But you don't have to get yourself stuck. You follow that? So that's what the sets look like. And the body can operate on them. It's a bit limiting, but it manages it. And you can see that sort of limitations it gets into by its obsession with compulsive games play. We'd do a lot better if the games play wasn't compulsive. But nevertheless, the body's got itself stuck with compulsive games play in the sex goals package. So it has to suffer the consequences. But I want you to bear with me with this material that I'm giving you. I'm just playing some of it back, and it does sound very, very complex. But there's a very good reason for it. It'll all start to come good, it will. Just bear with me and play it over and over until you've got it clear in your own mind. Just bear with me at the moment. Now let's go back, we now go for a little bit of light relief, you might say. We'll get off the topic of the body and we will take up what might be called ideal games play. The ideal games play in the sex goals package. The body does follow this within its limitations, and this is an ideal version of games play there in the sex goals package. The game would start with the male. He's the active one, the moving one. He directs a must-sex postulate at the female. The female, we're talking about human beings here, and the female would, detecting this must-sex postulate, she immediately goes into her mustn't-be-sexed mode and opposes the postulate. Immediately, sexual sensation is generated at the boundary between these opposing postulates, and both the parties enjoy the generation of the sexual sensation. And now the female must be careful not to come on too strong with her mustn't be sex postulate, because if she comes on too strong with it, she will overwhelm the male and drive him from must sex into mustn't sex. In other words, he'll feel he's been given the cold shoulder, and his postulate will change from must sex to mustn't sex. He will simply lose interest in the female if she comes on a bit strong. And if this happens, the female immediately notices that he's flipped from must sex to mustn't sex. Now, he's now in mustn't sex, she's in mustn't be sex, they're now occupying complementary postulates. There's no more sexual sensation being generated between them, and the game has ended. So to keep the game going now, she has to do something about it. She knows she's come on a bit strong. So what she does now, she flips over to must be sex. She flips over to a positive postulate. She gives him the come hither sign. As soon as she goes into must be sexed, and he's still in mustn't sex, the postulates are again opposing each other. Sexual sensation is again being generated, in which they can both sense and enjoy. But immediately this happens, the male, of course, he now sees the come hither signal, and he regains his interest in the female, and he now flips back to his positive must sex postulate. She, of course, senses this, and immediately she senses it in order to keep the game going, because they're now got complementary postulate situation again. In order to keep the game going, she now has to flip over back to her negative, to her mustn't be sexed, and thereby keep the sexual sensation being generated. So what it amounts to is that the way it works out, that no matter which postulate the one player creates and directs at the other one will mock up and generate and put out the opposing postulate. And so you'll always get the sexual sensation being generated. Now this becomes what we call a ritual mating dance between the couple. And it just goes on and on and on. They circle round and they get closer and closer and closer during the game. And eventually the terminals close completely, but they're still the game is still being played exactly as I've mentioned it, until physical sex is embarked upon. And even at the point of physical sex, this still we get this same postulate structure occurring at the physiological level. Male's must sex postulate at the physical level, effort level, becomes a forward pelvic thrust. The male's mustn't sex postulate becomes a backward pelvic withdrawal. The female's must be sex postulate becomes a backward pelvic thrust. And finally, the female's mustn't be sex postulate becomes a forward pelvic withdrawal. Now, as you examine these physical efforts, these bodily efforts which occur during during coitus, as you examine them, you're immediately struck by the fact that there's no difference physically between the male's must sex postulate with his forward pelvic thrust and the female's mustn't be sex postulate, which is a forward pelvic withdrawal. Similarly, there's no difference between the female's must be sex postulate of a backward pelvic thrust and the male's mustn't sex postulate of a backward pelvic withdrawal. The two, it's simply a matter of a rose by any other name smelling a sweet. You see, there's no difference between the forward pelvic thrust and the forward pelvic withdrawal and the backward pelvic thrust and the backward pelvic withdrawal. There's only the two motions involved, you see. So when we say, and this is exactly what we would expect to occur because of the identification, the false identification between must sex and mustn't be sexed, and must be sexed and mustn't sex in the to sex goals package at the physical, at the bodily level. Because of this false identification, we would expect these physical efforts to be identical, and they are identical. Do you see that? So, when I say at the physiological level that the body is completely addicted to this false identification that must sex equals mustn't be sexed, and must be sexed equals mustn't sex, must be sexed equals mustn't sex, I'm on very, very firm ground because I can prove it at an effort level in the body. It shows up at the effort level during the sex act. Now, looking at this tape, I see that we're getting towards the end of this tape, so let's just run it off to the end of the spool, Greg, and pick it up on the other side. There we are, back again, side two, same date. Now, there's one other physiological muscular action, which I haven't mentioned, that goes with these sexual postulates. First of all, we'll take the female. The female, when she's in her must-be-sex mode, with her backward pelvic thrust, is a relaxation of the muscles of her vagina and also a relaxation of the sphincter muscle on her rectum. When she goes into her mustn't-be-sex mode, the muscles in her vagina contract, closing the vagina up, closing the tubing off, and also the sphincter muscle in her rectum contracts. Similarly for the male when he's in his must sex mode with his forward pelvic thrust, he hasn't got a vagina, of course, but when he's in his must sex mode, the sphincter muscle on his rectum will contract, and when he goes into his backward pelvic withdrawal, his mustn't sex, the sphincter muscle on his rectum will relax. Now the significance of these will come about, I'll explain later. There is some significance while I'm mentioning it. Okay, now we'll press on. Now the immediate effect of the vaginal muscle contracting in the female's mustn't be sex mode is to allows her to grip his penis when he's thrusting with his forward pelvic thrust. As it thrusts into her vagina, she grips it, and that increases the sexual sensation. And then when he withdraws his penis, she relaxes it, relaxes the vaginal muscle, and on the return action. So the effect of this is to enhance the sexual sensation in the coital act between the partners. That's the immediate effect there. Now the coitus proceeds usually at a more and more frantic rate until a point of orgasm is reached. Now orgasm is has its own definite postulate structure, and it's one that you should know. Orgasm is reached at a definite point in the cycle. Now the male achieves orgasm when he becomes convinced that he has deprived the female of her mustn't be sexed postulate and has driven her from mustn't be sexed into must be sexed. That is orgasm for the male. The female goes into orgasm when she believes, when she becomes convinced that she has deprived the male of his mustn't sex postulate and has driven him into must sex. Now these are completely subjective considerations, but nevertheless, practiced lovers can manage it so that they have their orgasm simultaneously It's simply a matter of conviction between them. These are entirely subjective considerations, but that is what an orgasm consists of. At the point of orgasm, complementary postulates maintain. The male is in must sex and the female is in must be sexed. Sexual sensation drops after the point of orgasm, and everything drops off to zero. The act has been completed. The ejaculation of the sperm occurs, and some few hours later, if all goes well, one of the sperm will meet up with the female egg cell and fertilize it, and the female will be inseminated and become pregnant, which is the whole purpose of the game as far as the body is concerned. Now, when you examine these various physical efforts at the bodily level during coitus, although they do make sense during face-to-face coitus, which is what is normally practiced by mankind, by human beings, they make a lot more sense when the male enters the female from the rear, which is the ape mode, the original mode of the ape. For millions and millions of years, man's ancestors, the male entered the female from behind. This so-called missionary position, where the couple are facing face to face during the sex act, is a Johnny come lately. It's only in the last few thousand years there. So it's no surprise that the physiological efforts at the bodily level make a lot more sense. And it's worthwhile to trace them through, to look at them again, review them in the light of what I'm saying now. They make a lot more sense when the male enters the female from the rear. Well, there is the sex act at the very physical, basic physical level in terms of the postulates and in terms of the muscular actions of the human torso. And next, it behoves us to take up the subject of sexual ionization of body parts, because that's an important component in our understanding of bodily sex. Now, the first thing you should understand, sexual ionization, the ionization of the human body, is that it's fixed. It doesn't vary from one month to another. It's quite fixed. This is because the human beings don't have a sexual season like animals do. The apes and so forth, cats, dogs, most mammals, go into a sexual season and they reproduce during the sexual season. Then when they're out of season, they're not interested in sex at all. But because the human being is in sexual season all the year round, his ionization is permanent on his body. If it was permanent on the animal bodies, they would be in season all the year round. It is this ionization that determines whether a creature is in sexual season or not, the ionization on their body parts, sexual ionization. Now, the sexual ionization, as I say, is fixed in humans, and we'll now discuss what this sexual ionization is. It starts at birth, it's faint in birth, it increases in childhood, but it's still faint, it steadily increases during childhood, then it shoots up to a maximum at puberty and stays at that level for the rest of the person's life and fades very, very slowly in old age. But even in extreme old age, the ionization still remains much the same as it was at puberty. Okay, there's the cycle. That's what we're looking at. Now, which body parts are ionized and ionized with what? As I give you these ionizations, some of them are quite obvious, but some will come as a great surprise to you, I'm sure. Anyway, first of all, the sexual ionizations of the male body. The male penis and the male testicles have a must sex ionization, a permanent must sex ionization. And the only other permanent sexual ionization on the male body is the male rump, and the male rectum has a permanent must be sexed ionization. Now, the ionizations, the sexual ionizations of the female body are the area of the vagina, vulva, have, in the female, have a permanent must-be-sexed ionization. Also, the area of the rump and the rectum have a permanent must-be-sexed ionization. And also the female, she's the proud possessor of a vestigial penis called a clitoris. And this vestigial penis has a residual must-sex ionization. Also, in the mature female, the breasts have a transient must-be-sexed ionization, but it's transient, it's not permanent, it's transient. And doesn't really consider us in this study, because we're only interested in the permanent ionizations at this stage. So they are the ionizations of the male and female body. As I say, some of them are obvious and some of them are no doubt surprising to you. We'll take up the female ionizations first. The surprising ones there is the ionization, sexual ionization of the clitoris. That one is not immediately obvious, and it's but nevertheless it is there. There's no equivalent ionization in the male of the vagina, simply because the male has no vestigial vagina, so there's no equivalent ionization there. But the female does have a vestigial penis, and it's ionized with a must be sex. Now, this phenomena is upsetting to the female. You'll find this: she's got the back half of her body permanently ionized, must be sexed, and she's got this little tiny vestigial area at the front, which is ionized, must-sexed. Well, must-sex is a male ionization superimposed at the front of an otherwise female body with its heavy must-be-sexed ionization at the back. Now, the female, you'll find, tends to occupy the back of her body, and she tends to regard as her sexual identity the back of her body, and this little bit at the front tends to go into the class of not self, because you remember of the double bind is that the because of the sexual double bind, the class of to sex and to be sex cannot both exist simultaneously in the same class. So the female cannot both be in the class of to be sexed and be in the class of to sex at the same time. So if she's in a feminine class of to be sexed, then this little bit at the front, this masculine ionization in the clitoris, must be in the class of not self. And she tends to put it off and dissociate herself from it. And you will find that this slight dissociation in the female, it can be intense, this sexual dissociation in the female between herself, her femininity, and this little masculine component in her clitoris, is the basis of lesbianism. Is the basis of lesbianism in the female. If she concentrates very, very heavily, gets involved very heavily with sex to do with the clitoris rather than to do with her vagina and vulva, then she can easily find herself involved in lesbian practices with other females. But if she concentrates exclusively on her feminine side, which is the sexuality associated with her vagina and vulva and rump, etc., then of course she escapes the lesbianism. So there is the source of lesbianism in the female. It's worth knowing if you ever want to erase it in therapy. But bear in mind, even if it doesn't show as lesbianism, there's always conflict in the female sexuality between her must be sexed ionization, which she considers her own sexual identity at the rear, and this little bit of vestigial penis at the front, which is ionized with a must sex postulate. So there's always conflict in her mind. So she doesn't escape conflict, the female, at all. She doesn't escape it. She's got her own sexual conflict in her body. All is not in harmony because of that vestigial penis that she's got. It upsets her. It's upsetting to her, fundamentally. It upsets the harmony of her body. Now, over to the male, the high mass sex ionization on the male penis and the male testicles is quite obvious and to be expected and doesn't need any further discussion. But what on earth is this with the male doing with his buttocks, his rump and his rectum having a must be sexed ionization? Thereby hangs a tale, and we'll have to tell you this tale to understand this. This is the source of homosexuality in males, and it's a great puzzle to every male. And I have got to the source of it. I do know where it comes from, and I'll give you the data. Once you understand where it comes from, it will stop bothering you. Now, to understand it, we have to go and look back into little creatures living in the wild. If you examine various creatures living in the wild in colonies, particularly herbivores, creatures like stags, kangaroos, and so forth, you'll find one thing you're struck that in their mating season, there's an enormous carnage of loss of young males in fights. They get into fights. It is well known. You can read it up in any book by any book on zoology, and you can go out into the wild and see these deers fighting each other during the mating season. What happens is that the male deer, the mature male deer, he's a big fella, and he collects a harem. He has his own harem of female deer, and he guards them quite possessively. And young males grow up. And as they grow up, they sexually mature, and they cast envious eyes on his harem, you see. And all the time they're nosing around, trying to get a bit of sex from these female deer of his harem. And, of course, he doesn't care for this one little bit. So they end up in fights, and you find the stags fighting. Well, the fights are to the death amongst stags and amongst kangaroos. Kangaroos got exactly the same mating habits, and the fights are to the death amongst the kangaroos too. And unfortunately, the young stags stand no chance against these big stags, and they just simply get slaughtered. If they're not slaughtered, they're maimed and go away and die in misery. And the whole thing is very, very wasteful of their stock, of the young male breeding stock. And you might argue, of course, that, well, it's nature red in tooth and claw, and it's the survival of the fittest. Yes, 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 but it's still wasteful if it can be avoided. You see, a species does survive best if it reserves its fighting for members which aren't of its own species. In other words, when a species starts to fight amongst itself, it's inefficient. It's an inefficient thing because it's fighting its own species. It's fighting itself. It does much better. It survives much better, a species does, if it reserves its fighting for creatures which are not of its own species. You understand me? So when I say it's wasteful, I mean exactly that. It's very wasteful. And the stags and the kangaroos have never solved this problem. But the apes did. They solved it. Now, the problem also exists among predators, lions and tigers. They have the same problem. They've got similar mating habits. Now, they've solved it too, but their solution is quite a different solution to the ape solution. So it doesn't concern us. But other creatures have solved the problem too. The stags never did solve it. The kangaroos never solved it. And to this day, they still have this ritual annual slaughter of young males. But as I say, the apes solved it. And we're interested in that because the apes are mankind's immediate ancestors. We're descended from the apes at a physical, bodily level. So we're very interested in the ape solution of that problem. And it's very, very relevant to the subject of the feminine ionization on the rear end of the male human. Now, there's no doubt that some millions and millions of years ago, the apes too suffered this carnage amongst their ape colonies and so forth. Every year in the mating season, the young adolescent apes would come up, and there'd be the big ape there with his harem, and the young adolescent would be driven by sexual urges to fight the big fellow, and he would almost invariably lose. And the carnage would occur. But the apes, possibly because the apes were a little bit smarter than many other animals, but the apes came up with a solution to it, and they certainly, their solution worked. We can imagine a hypothetical scene that one day some young adolescent ape was fighting to the death with some large ape who owned the harem, and it got to a point where he realised that he was being slaughtered, and if the fight continued, as he had to go on fighting, and he was going to get killed. So in a desperation, he said to himself, "Well, what the hell? Is there any way I can prevent myself from getting killed here? This big fella's going to kill me, and he's not going to relent until he's killed me. I can't do anything about it." So in final desperation, he suddenly remembered this young adolescent ape watching the female apes, and he realised that the male ape, the dominant male ape, can always be appeased by a female ape. This is true in the ape kingdom. The female ape can always appease the angry male ape by presenting her rump to him. As soon as she presents her rump to him, he mounts her sexually, makes a few pelvic thrusts, and dismounts, and his honour is satisfied, you might say, and he goes his way, and she goes her way. And this adolescent ape, millions of years ago, fighting this adolescent male ape, fighting this big ape, he must have realised this, or the big ape who was the owner of the harem, he must have spotted this, and in desperation to save his own life, he offered his own rump to the male ape. And the male ape, of course, once a rump was offered to him, he immediately assumed that this must be a female he was fighting. So he did the thing his native conditioning would cause him to do. He simply mounted the adolescent male ape, made a few pelvic thrusts, dismounted, and went his way. We can presume that the adolescent male ape, he must have breathed a sigh of relief. He saved his life, and more importantly, his solution worked. So next time he came along to the harem, he knew how to save his life. He had experience. He had experiential factor here of knowing how to solve the problem. He could fight to the point of where he was losing the battle. Then he knew that he could always end the fight by acting as a female, acting up as a female. And so he no doubt used this mechanism there. But other eyes were watching him, lots and lots of, as you were watching any ape colony, when these mating fights occur in the ape colony, as in any other animal colony, there's lots and lots of youngsters who watch the fights with great interest. It's of great significance to them, these fights are, and lots of young male apes must have been watching this adolescent ape when he presented his rump, and they learned too. They spotted it. So when their turn came to try and become the leader of the tribe and take on the big fellow, they learned how to save their life too. And of course, apes are pretty smart. They're pretty quick learners, you know, and things like that. And so it got into their culture, and it spread. Now, why would it spread through the ape colony, through the ape culture? Well, simply because those who practiced this system survived. The adolescent ape who practiced this system, the adolescent ape who practiced it, he eventually would grow up and become a fully mature male ape, would go off and get a harem of his own. If he didn't practice this system, there's a good 80% chance that he'd get slaughtered. And he would never survive, and he would never, his genes would never be passed on to posterity. So the ones that adopted this system had their genes passed on to posterity. The ones who didn't have their genes passed on. So after a few hundreds generations, a few thousand generations of apes, you would expect to find by pure Darwinian evolution that all the apes in the colonies, in the area, and it would all be practicing this same system, this solution to the problem of how to stop the carnage. Now, the solution not only is a good solution, you might say, well, it's a good solution for the adolescent male ape, but how does it benefit the big fellow? Does it help him? Yes, it does. As a matter of fact, it's a good solution for him. Because look, as soon as the adolescent ape who's fighting him for dominance quits the fight and offers his rump, and the big fella mounts him, once the adolescent ape quits the fight and offers his rump, he's gone into the female universe, and he's offering his rump up with a must be sex postulate on it. He's become feminine. And while the adolescent ape is in the feminine universe, he can't be in the masculine universe because of the double bind. Follow? So, as far as the big fella's concerned, he can keep all the adolescent apes in the community in the feminine violence. If he can keep them in the feminine violence, they're not in the masculine violence, or not use violence, we'll use universe. While they're in the feminine universe, they're not in the masculine universe. And if they're not in the masculine universe, they're not interested in his female harem. They leave his females alone. You see, so it does benefit him too. So he's only got to. So it benefits both of them. The young apes get benefited, it saves their lives. The older ape gets benefited, that it stops these youngsters pestering his flock all the time. He just has to assert his authority once or twice, they use the mechanism, and after that, the ionization is there, and that's it. Then he can leave them amongst his females. They won't interfere while they're in the feminine violence. And they're likely to stay in the feminine universe while he's present. And as he never strays very far away from his harem, just his presence keeps these adolescents in the feminine universe, keeps them out of their masculine universe. So it works for all parties concerned, you see. But it's a purely a male thing. It's got nothing to do with the females. Yes, it's got nothing to do with the females. I mean, the reason the female ape gets her rump and her rectum ionized with the must-be sex postulate is because of the close proximity of these body parts to her vulva and her vagina. And the fact that in sexual play with apes, she almost certainly gets her rectum entered many, many times by sheer accident. And so you quite expect the female ape would have a positive must be sex ionization on her rump and on her rectum. It will be quite natural for this to be. So it doesn't concern the female at all. In other words, she always did know how to appease the male. She simply presented her rump to him. It was the young males who had to learn how to do it to save their lives. You see, and they did learn. And most importantly for our purposes, the purposes of the human being, is that we are related to them. We are the descendants of those apes, and we have the same physiological ionization. You see, it wasn't long from these apes before they were being born with this ionization. It can happen. It can happen by genetics. There, that that sooner or the apes colony, all the males eventually in the colony, by usage, In by games play, would end up with their rumps positively with a must be sexed ionization. And well, that could only go on for a few thousand years. After that, they'd be born with the positive ionization. It's the way the body is, you know. And you can find out about this in any book on evolutionary theory. But by simple usage, the body adapts to it eventually, and so we would expect that apes would be born with a positive must be sex ionizations on their rumps and rectums. Male apes would be born, and the human beings, of course, today are males. Human beings are the same. They're just born with it. They're born with their ionization. Now, the problem is that although this mechanism is of tremendous survival value to the apes in their colonies and in their way of life, the ionization on the rump, the feminine ionization on the rump and rectum on the males, is of no earthly use in our society. You see that? The thing's just a complete nuisance. And because nobody knows where it comes from, you can't look up a book anywhere and find out about it, because all these sexual postulates are a mystery. Nobody knows anything about ionization of body parts because they're not aware of them. It's just the whole thing's a complete mystery. We have vast number of males, human males wandering around the planet believing they're homosexuals, because they're aware of their this positive ionization on their rear end, the positive feminine ionization. The thing becomes a psychological nightmare. Just as the female tends to dissociate from the front of her body, we find the male tends to dissociate from the rear of his body. He tends to, his masculine identity tends to be at the front of his body, associated with his penis and testicles. And this bit behind him, he comes to dissociate himself from. He can't be both in the class of to sex and the class of to be sex. The double bind says so. He can't do it, so he has to dissociate. That must, if he's in the class of self and the self is in the class of must sex, then the must be sex component on his rear end must be in the class of not self. There's the dissociation, and we have the perfect dissociation, and this is what happens with the male, just as the male can easily go into homosexuality. Similarly with the female, she can dissociate from the masculine ionization on her clitoris and can easily go into lesbianism, which is just as great a mystery to the females as homosexuality is to the males. So by examining this subject of ionization, we have an immediate solution to two of the greatest sexual problems that have always been with human beings, subject of lesbianism and homosexuality. We see where it comes from. Now you might say, well, if this is so, how come that the zoologists haven't spotted it? I mean, they've been studying these apes for the last 50 years, and for the last 100, 150 years, casually. Why haven't they spotted it? Well, of course they're aware of this mating habits of the ape. They know all about the male apes turning his rump to the dominant male who owns the hair. They know all about it. It's written up in all the zoology books. But what they don't know about, and what we know about, is the four sexual postulates of the sex goals package. And we also know about this subject of body ionization, the ionization of body parts, which the zoologists don't know anything about. So they cannot correlate the subject of the mating habits of the ape, they cannot correlate that with homosexuality in the male. Follow? There simply was no way they can do it, because the missing link in the chain are the four postulates, other postulates of the sex goals package, and the whole subject of sexual ionization of human body parts. Once you know of the ionization of the body parts, it sticks out like a sore thumb. It's obvious where the human male gets the sexual ionization of his rump from, where he gets his feminine ionization of his rump from. And it's equally obvious that he isn't going to erase it in therapy. It's a genetic thing. It's quite natural. There's no good in fighting it. He's born with it, and he will die with it, just as the female is born with the male ionization on her clitoris. She's born with it and will die with it, and so she might as well learn to live with it. There's nothing odd about it. Nothing odd about the male's feminine ionization of his rump. Now, this is it. If you understand this, really, really got it, it will help you enormously to take the sex goals package apart. If you don't understand it, or you fight it, or reject it, as you might well do, then I can assure you, you simply won't get the sex goals package apart in therapy. And you understand me. I'm not making this up. I'm not a writer of science fiction. I'm simply a research psychologist. And this data has popped up when I've been researching the subject of sex. And it's, you need the data. I'll tell you, you need the data, because you will need the data in order to erase the sex goals package in therapy. Okay, but now I made that, we've got this absolutely clear. Okay, finally, the last thing I want to take up is the subject of gender symbols. Now, the subject of gender symbols is very interesting to mankind. Most gender symbols you'll find that he uses, well, first of all gender symbols are gender specific, and the gender symbol is caught up in the double bind on the to sex goals package. In other words, the every gender symbol that you come across will follow the pattern that must sex equals mustn't be sexed, and must be sexed equals mustn't sex, and it also follows the pattern that male equals non-female and female equals non-male. In other words, it follows the double bind of the bodies, double bind in the sex goals package as far as the body is concerned. And because the gender symbol follows this double bind, you cannot erase them in therapy until you have erased the sex goals package. Now, this is dreadfully important. You can simply waste hours in therapy trying to erase gender symbols out of the mind at level 5C. And you simply won't do it until the sex goals package has been erased at level 5B. Once you've erased the sex goals package at 5B, then all the gender symbols at 5C will erase easily. Now, I'm not going to say it again. I've said it once and that's it. That's the truth of the matter. That's the way it is. So don't waste time with trying to erase gender symbols until you've erased the sex goals package at level 5B. Now let's talk a little more about gender symbols. They're of considerable interest to mankind rather than other animals, particularly the subject of clothes. Most gender symbols are clothes. There are some that are non-clothes, but the most important ones to human beings are clothes. His gender symbols and his clothes. Now, why would this be? Well, it comes from this fixed positive ionization of the body parts in humans. And the only way the human being can feel free to move is move from the positive to the negative side of the postulates in the sex goals package, is to cover up the fixed positive ionization on his body parts. In other words, a girl, say, with her fixed must be sex ionization there, will wear a dress. Well, without the dress on, there's not much you can do. I mean, there's the body part, and it's got this this fixed positive must be sex ionization, which is visible and there. But she feels that if she covers it up with a dress, she can change the ionization of the dress from must be sexed to mustn't be sexed at will. You see that? Even though the body part underneath still retains its fixed ionization. But she can now face the world in games play and change the ionization of her gender symbols. You see that? And so this gives her more fluidity, more flexibility in sexual games play. Similarly with a male with his clothes, he does better with his clothes. He likes to wear the clothes because he can change the ionization, the sexual ionization from must sex to mustn't sex of his clothes, but he can't change the sexual ionization of his body parts because they're fixed. So you'll find that humans in sexual games play almost invariably prefer to wear clothes rather than conduct sexual games play without any clothes on. Without any clothes on, they're rather limited in their sexual responses. But when they've got their clothes on, they can show an almost infinite range of sexual responses. And the whole thing is done with gender symbols. It's done with gender symbols. And most of these gender symbols are clothes. Now, do you see the role of the gender symbol in human sexual games play? I've summarized it very, very briefly because I'm running out of space on this tape. But there is the absolute essence of it. You can test the truth of what I'm saying by an examination of children. One of the great tests of the increasing sexual maturity in a child is their use of clothes. That when they're infants and very, very young children, they just run around. Doesn't concern them very much if they're wearing clothes or not. But as they mature, as they grow up, older children prefer to wear clothes, simply because the ionization, their sexual ionization on their body is increasing, and they feel less comfortable walking around without any clothes on. So they prefer to put clothes on so they can play their sexual games, the little childhood sexual games that they do play, and they all play them, children. The little sexual games that they play with each other, they can play while they've got their clothes on. That's why older children prefer to keep their clothes on. and younger children, it doesn't bother them, you see. So there's plenty of experimental evidence to back up what I'm saying on the subject of gender symbols in humans. Plenty of it. The evidence is all there if you care to look at it. In fact, every bit of data I've given you on this tape, there's plenty of evidence to back it up. You'll find evidence in Life and Living to back up everything I've said. It's all there. Once you know it, you'll find the evidence to back it up. I've had to find it, but to find this material out by doing the research there and finding it and digging it out. Once you've got the data, and you'll easily find the experimental evidence to the observational evidence to back up the data, the theoretical material that I'm giving you. It's all there. You'll find it there if you care to look. Really? Finally, how do you approach the data on this tape? Well, try and accept the data, even if it might feel strange to you, it might feel abhorrent to you, you may be revulsed by it, but don't reject it out of hand. Just accept it as being provisionally true, as being possibly true, provisionally true, and just bear in mind that it may be provisionally true as you're working with the To Sex Goals package in therapy. As you come to work with this To Sex Goals package, you'll find that more and more of this data, more and more material showing up, and this data I've given you starts to make more and more sense. If you reject this data out of hand that I've given you on this tape, you will never erase the To Sex Goals package in therapy. If you reject it all out of hand, I can tell you that you'll still be trying to erase the To Sex Goals package when you're an old man with a long white beard. Now, on the other hand, if you use this data I've given you on this tape and work with the To Sex Goals package, you can erase every sexual quirk that anyone has ever conceived of out of the human mind. You can erase the lot. You can even erase Sigmund Freud's carpet slippers. Now, you can't do better than that, can you? So that's it. Bye-bye for now. All the best.